This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. This week on the Compass, we sit in on a meeting of enthusiasts who are working to make Port Townsend a recognized center for a somewhat obscure sport, and we hear from an activist who is working to help an endangered seabird and the ancient forests save each other. So now, let's go inside the Compass.
Going to try to play at low tide as opposed to, you know, you can come up onto a beach up to here, but at that point, the sand is so soft, it's just a completely different way of playing the game.
What time were you thinking it would start?
Didn't you send it out for 10?
For what?
Sign-ups at 9:30 and start at 10?
We start to play at 10, and we have 4 40-minute matches, and the person up here goes, you know, and that lets everybody know that there's 5 minutes till the end of the end that they're on, and that gives them time to play, let's say, to 10 points or 40 minutes, whatever comes first, and then they come back up and report their scores. And we're going to use it as a kickoff for the fundraiser to get money to put the 12 courts in at Fort Worden.
A half dozen dedicated aficionados of a somewhat obscure sport named pétanque gathered at the beach next to the poorhouse parking lot one recent Saturday afternoon to forward plans to make Port Townsend into something of a national center for the particular form of boules that is wildly popular in such places as the south of France, but which is only recently finding favor in the United States. With the official formation a couple of years ago of the Port Townsend Pétanque Alliance, PT has become a visible presence in that emerging trend, and under the leadership of local musician and pétanque ace player Robert Force, the organization is looking to further increase that recognition by building a world-class pétanque tournament court at Fort Worden. But the parking lot meeting was not all about play. There was also official business to be conducted.
I'm going to call the meeting to order. This is the annual meeting of the Port Townsend Pétanque Alliance. And we are required by our bylaws to have an actual meeting. Whether anybody attends it or not, we have to have it. This is the time. We have 6 of us here, and 6 out of the current 27 members who are our members. Names were submitted. The only names that were actually submitted for the 2 vacant positions were Silas Holmes and Robert Force. I prepared secret ballots for any of you that want to. According to our bylaws, I went ahead and made envelopes, but we have to start some kind of precedent.
Well,
so since Amy was our original board secretary, I'm going to give her the blank ballots.
Ooh.
We have 6. Okay. Just go ahead and lick it then, since Doug Brick is board member, can officially seal it.
All
right. The results of this election will be made public as soon as 3 of us get together to actually open this envelope.
Once the ballots were filled out and collected, there was an opportunity for some less formal discussion. I asked about the Pétanque Alliance's plans for growth.
We expect to grow 40, 50, 80 members probably over the next year, year and a half, as we begin to build the Fort Worden terrain and get all different kinds of folks, hopefully youth involved. There's 2,000 players in the United States. Only 200 are youth. The United States has never won an international medal in the last 60 years that this has existed. 17 million people play it worldwide, so we got to get our youth involved. It's kind of like what soccer was 20, 30 years ago. You couldn't find soccer anyway, and now the women's soccer team took the World Cup. I mean, that's making it available and having people interested and people teaching it. And pétanque is one of those cross-age, multi-generational games where it truly has a level playing field for whoever is playing. The actual size of the ball and the weight of the ball are custom designed to fit the thrower. The game stays the same, but you can throw a heavier or a lighter ball. By the way, the reason that Steve is down here with this little fuzzy thing is that he does a radio show for our own local radio station.
KPTZ.
KPTZ. KPTZ Radio. Eclectic.
Authentic.
Authentic and eclectic. Well, this is as authentic as it gets. You should probably describe that we're standing here at the end of Decatur Street next to the poorhouse between the Prosper Natural Health looking at a quarter mile of exposed, wonderful beaches. It's one of the, I think, one of the fewest used beaches in our community, but it's south-facing, it's warm, and this is where we'll hold our third annual low tide tournament, which is the subject under discussion at the moment. Silas.
The third annual low tide tournament will be held here, and it will be not the most competitive tournament. It will be mostly for people who are maybe new to the sport and maybe people who want to play in a different style because there's not going to be as much rolling. It's going to be more absorbent of the bulls. It's going to start at 10. Sign-ins at 9:30. You don't have to pre-register. It's free. Bring your own lunch.
Bring your own bulls.
Bring your own bulls, but we'll provide some bulls. It's basically just open to everybody. The idea is to promote new people to play the game and just to have fun and play the game in a way that most people don't play, because normally it's played more like on a surface like this, or that's a...
What is this surface?
Just, hard-packed ground. So that's soft beach sand, so it doesn't roll as much.
So it's actually easier to play on the soft sand, is it just different?
It's just different. It just depends. It's harder to shoot on that kind of court because the ball that you hit probably won't go as far. That's the basic idea.
And it's a fun court because we've discovered in the past, you get down to, let's say you throw the ball, you're going to throw it 15 feet, goes up in the air in a little arc, it drops down onto the sand, and all the clams that are around it spurt up 3 or 4 feet. So we consider that one of the hazards of play, is that you may be squirted by a clam.
So this event will be open to the general public, whether they have ever played pétanque before, or even if they don't even know what pétanque is.
Exactly. We want to have a fun day on the beach, introduce the game, create some interest in getting youth programs started, get people of all ages to come and play, and learn the fundamentals of the game.
What are the fundamentals of the game? I mean, just briefly.
You take the cochonnet, which is a small wooden ball, and you throw it out 6 to 10 meters. And then you take your metal ball, and then you get it as close as you can. The other team has to go until they're closer than you. And then you score as many points as you have balls closest to the small ball. So it's basically the same as bocce, except for a slight variation in ball size, distance of throwing, and you have to stand in a circle. You can't walk. You can't get a different angle by walking around.
You have to stand in a circle.
Yeah, you have
around.
A circle that's, 18 inches?
20 inches.
20 inches?
Basically half a meter.
Half a meter in diameter. And then you stand, everybody has to stand, and then
shoot from within that circle.
Yeah, everybody has to shoot within that circle.
I see.
And then you can move that to where the cochonnet landed the last time, and that's where the game starts the next time. And this is played in open terrain, which means you can play in any direction you want, whereas most of the time the court is confined to 4 meters in width and 15 meters in length.
So the idea is you're throwing these balls, weigh about a pound and a half, and they're about the size of a tennis ball or a baseball hard ball, and they're about half the size and half the weight of a bocce ball. And this concept about pétanque, the name of the game, means feet together in French, and it was developed because people who have handicaps of one kind or another, a wheelchair, a cane, whatever, it gives them an equal advantage. You just have to have one wheel of the wheelchair in the circle, or your cane can be outside the circle. The idea is to take away, I can run, I'm stronger, I can run up, I can throw it faster because I have the extra muscle. And that's why the people with less musculature, like kids, can be equally competitive, and many of them are. Silas played with a young man from Canada at an Edmonds tournament last week, and he was a deadly shot. And so to level the playing field, literally, is the name of the game. That's why different ages, different abilities, strengths, and whether in a wheelchair or using a cane, it keeps it even.
Maybe I could get a little bit of sort of personal color here. So, I mean, how did
these are our most colorful people. These two, they're really colorful.
How did you come to pétanque yourself?
Amy introduced me to it.
I see. And who are you?
Kirsty.
Kirsty.
Young.
Yeah. And Amy?
Dahlberg.
I see.
Well, all right. So you've just passed the baton, I think, to Amy. So.
Well, I saw it in the paper because the poorhouse advertised for a tournament. So I thought, hey, that sounds like fun. I'll sign up. So I signed up with three of my gal friends, and we had a good time. And
had you ever heard of Petanque before?
I'd never heard of Petanque. No, not at all. But I'd seen him playing at the poorhouse and knew basically it was like bocce ball, but not quite. Yeah. So
how long have you been playing now?
I'm in my third season. And we won a game. And you know why we won a game? Because this man right here didn't show up.
Thank you.
It was our first
game. I see
you're
he's one of your regular opponents, is he?
Yes, yeah. He plays.
So how many on a team? Are you on a team together?
There's usually two on a team, or it could be three or four, because it's sort of a bar league. It's not, you know. I think normally there's two or three, right?
Normally it's either triples, doubles, or singles, and it can be men's doubles, or it can be mixed, or it can be mixed triples, or like men's and women's triples. That's kind of how it breaks down.
Yeah.
Or you can play what's called, I think it's only in Portland, it's called Webfoot, and you can either play a single person with six bulls, or two people with three bulls, or three people with two bulls.
And why is that called a Webfoot?
I have no idea.
Those Portland people, they're wacky.
All right, so you seem more expert on this game than maybe anyone, maybe Robert's more, but so how did you come to it?
I came to it, started playing here with Chen at the bar. It was...
Well, who brought it here?
Well, Ned Virginia built the first court, and I think they had talked to Robert about what it was. Is that what happened? I don't know exactly.
All right, Robert, how did you get involved?
I was... I'm a musician. I was on tour, and I had a gig in Cincinnati, and the people who put me up for the weekend, he was an older man, a French master who had played this game for his entire life, and he had a court in his backyard, and so in between the things I did for the music festival, we would spend time in his backyard, and playing him, I played 50 games with him over a three-day weekend and won the last one. And it was kind of like...
Really? You beat the French master?
Well, it was kind of like, okay, Grasshopper, you've learned enough now. Well, 50-1, I mean, you know, sometimes, you know, the best of team will lose, but literally 49 straight drubbings. And, you know, and he taught me. And I came back home and I saw that Ned and Virginia were putting this the poorhouse pub together. And I just pitched the idea, since it was in the old impound lot, that kind of a hard gravel surface is the traditional way. The game is not played on lawns; it's usually played in driveways. So that's what got it started here. About the same time that they started this 4 years ago.
So 4 years ago, it's been, you know, not that long in Port Townsend, yet you were telling me the other day that Port Townsend now actually figures large on the national scene.
Well, we just had nationals a couple of weeks ago down in Portland. This club sent seven teams. Of those seven teams, five of those teams made it into their respective, what let's call it the Sweet 16. They made it into the finals round. And of those teams, one of them, the women's team, Gerda Jorgensen and Rebecca Howe went on to take the national women's silver. And so that sends the message that we've got people who are playing competitive and that a younger group of people are playing it. And so that definitely opened eyes on a national scene that here in Port Townsend, by our lovely terrain by the ocean and the new one we're going to build at Fort Worden, with your help, ladies and gentlemen, that's right. Don't be shy. Call Robert Force.
Well, so tell me about the dream, the Fort Worden dream. What is that?
Well, I think we all share the dream. We basically Fort Worden and the whole Public Development Authority and a lifelong learning, an opportunity to create cultural understanding. The game is played all over the world. The Thais are second in the world. The Spanish are third. The French are first. It's played all over North Africa and Southeast Asia. And so the cultural opportunity as well as the sports opportunity and the camaraderie of different age groups of people getting together doing something common. And that's the idea that was presented to Fort Worden, and they said, yes, let's do this. And so we're in the process of raising about $7,500 to put in an area think of it as a large kind of graveled lot, kind of look like a parking lot, but in that parking lot is capable of holding up to 12 courts. So, and we will give instruction to people, we as a club, teach people to play, and hopefully grow a group of young competitors that will represent us nationally and abroad.
Now, this sounds like it's probably not the most costly sports facility that's ever been constructed. I mean, what do you estimate it's going to cost to create this?
$7,500.
$7,500.
That our goal is to raise the money to do so. And the game, you know, is played with metal balls, and the cheapest metal ball is about maybe they're $6 a piece. You know, and
you need three of them, right?
Once a person gets into the game and they have the bulls they're going to play with, it takes a long time to break a metal ball, and so you're going to have that the guy that I played with in Cincinnati, he had the game, the same balls he'd been playing with for 50 or 60 years, so. Buy in once, and unless you're like the rest of us, well, I want a little bit different. I mean, the opportunity to spend money, like any other sport, is certainly there. You can buy different sizes, different alloys, whatever, you know, stainless steel, carbon.
Now, who around here has the expertise to really consult with when somebody is buying their first set? I mean, you know, how are we to figure
this out? Well, Don over there, he went out onto eBay, and he ended up buying just many different kinds of balls. Some were traditional balls, some were, cross-hatched and heavy, and others were light. And, you know, and anybody that's played the game by now in this group of people, you know, the 25 people or so, let's say 18 of those people, if you see anybody at the poorhouse playing, you can ask them, and they'll certainly know.
Yeah. What have you settled on now? What are you using?
Well, I just ordered a second set of bulls, so I play, right now I'm playing a 77 diameter bull with a 695 gram weight, made by the MS Petanque company out of France. That's the bull I'm using.
And is that heavy or light? I have no concept of.
That's light. I'm generally what's called a shooter, and my job is to, when we're playing a game, I throw the ball and try to strike out the opponent's ball who may be closer, as opposed to a pointer who is going to just simply try to get closer. So as such, since I'm often throwing a long distance, I want a lighter ball that's bigger, so I have more opportunity to strike where it is I'm looking at. He's got some bulls here.
Yeah, he's got some bulls there. Yeah, those make a good sound. Good radio sound there.
Thanks.
We played some low tiding.
Two, so I need to.
Okay, let's
go
down and play a game.
An hour or so.
I don't have a cushionade, so we.
I got one. I got a bunch.
Meeting adjourned?
Yeah.
With the meeting adjourned, the players headed for the beach for a few rounds of petanque.
Okay, so first he's closest. I'm second, so that means that Amy's up for throwing. And she winds up. She takes the pitch. She looks down the long road there at the cushionade. There's a hush in the crowd. And she puts it within 6 inches of the cochonade, the little pig, as it's called. And Robert Force is up.
You should be in radio.
Yeah, we want to do a little bit of this on the radio. You know, the cochonade, the people are looking in the gallery. There's a hush in the gallery right now as Robert steps up to the throwing line. Ooh.
Whoa,
ooh,
nice.
And he lands right on the cochonade, kicks it up the beach about another 2 or 3 inches, and that puts Kirsty back up.
Just a reminder, that tournament is on August 1st, starting at 10 o'clock. Registration at 9:30. That's Saturday, August 1st, at the Decatur Street Beach, down by the poorhouse. With the Port Townsend Petanque Alliance at the Decatur Street Beach, this is Steve Evans reporting for KPTZ Community Radio News. Frustrated by an 18-year delay on the part of the Washington Department of Natural Resources in formulating a permanent science-based plan to conserve the old-growth forests required for nesting by an endangered seabird, a consortium of environmental organizations has pooled resources to educate the public and to bring pressure on the DNR to finally issue the state-mandated plan. Kevin Schmeltzlin, campaign coordinator of the Marbled Murrelet Survival Project, was in Port Townsend recently, and I talked with him briefly before his presentation to the North Olympic Group of the Sierra Club at the Community Center. So maybe you could tell me something about the decline of the marble murrelet. What are the figures?
Well, the species was first listed under the Federal Endangered Species List in 1992. However, in just the last 10 years, in the last decade, we've seen the species decline 50%, according to at-sea surveys by Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. So the species went from over 10,000 individuals in 2005 to under 5,000 in 2014.
And what is behind this decline?
Well, the marbled murrelet's a forest-nesting seabird, so they depend on both a healthy terrestrial environment or a forest-nesting habitat as well as a healthy marine environment. So there's lots of issues affecting the marbled murrelet, unfortunately. But the primary reason for the decline is the deforestation of their forest-nesting habitat.
Right. They require old-growth trees, I understand, in order to nest. I mean, they have to have branches that are like, I don't know, 8 inches or so in a diameter, is that right?
That's correct. Yeah, generally they need branches at least 8 inches wide with some sort of depression or deformity in there, and moss or lichens act as a padding. So they have pretty specific features that they're looking for in their nesting platforms, and the more we've logged over the years, the more of those we've removed from the state of Washington.
What kind of work has been done? I know that it took a long time to even find out where the murrelet nested. I mean, it was like that was a big mystery for a long time, right? How has it gone now in terms of figuring out like how many nesting areas there are and how many birds are in each of those nesting areas? I mean, have the actual nesting areas been identified now, or is this still a mystery where some of the birds are nesting?
There's still a mystery over where a lot of the murrelets are nesting. We do know where at least a few hundred are in the state of Washington, which is, as you mentioned, a big increase from 40 years ago, 30 years ago, even 20 years ago. In the late 1990s and into the 2000s, the State Department of Natural Resources, along with the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, did a good amount of surveying to figure out where these nesting sites are, but we still don't know where most of them are because it's difficult to find a murrelet nest. You have to be generally climbing up into the forest canopies in order to actually verify. So you look for certain behavior from the marbled murrelets, flying under the canopy and some other things that they'll do to give you an idea that they're nesting in that area. But to find the actual nesting sites can be quite difficult.
And so, of course, if you don't know exactly where the nesting sites are, it's hard then to protect the areas, right?
Right. And I'd say that's part of the problem with the interim conservation strategy that we're working under. So currently, the only real protection that the marbled murrelet has on state forest land is the protection of known occupied nesting sites with a 100-meter buffer around those. But because we don't know where most of the murrelets are nesting, a lot of those nesting sites aren't being protected. So what we're hoping for is a science-based plan that protects more forest habitat, highly suitable habitat, so that the nesting sites that are there but aren't necessarily known by humans can be protected, but also so that in the future we'll have more nesting sites available.
So in other words, if there are old growth trees that would be suitable for murrelet nesting, then to sort of make the presumption that murrelets may be using those areas.
That's correct.
Is there actually a legislative basis for making that assumption?
Yeah. So currently, the Department of Natural Resources is coming up with a long-term conservation strategy. And in 2004, the DNR, or Department of Natural Resources, commissioned a science team. So this team of top murrelet experts from all over the Pacific Northwest to gather as much information about the marbled murrelet as possible and then come out with recommendations for this long-term conservation strategy. And the science team laid out what areas need to be protected, what areas would contribute the most to the survival and recovery of the marbled murrelet. That report was published in 2008. 7 years later, we're still waiting for anything to be done with that. And we're not even sure if the Department of Natural Resources will take much of that science report into account. But that's what we're strongly pushing for with the Murrelet Survival Project, is to have a long-term conservation strategy be based on that science.
I see. So now this is a fairly new project, right?
That's correct. The Murrelet Survival Project was created about a year ago, just about a year ago now, by Sierra Club, along with Seattle Audubon Society, Olympic Forest Coalition, and Washington Forest Law Center. A Sierra Club especially was doing a little bit of outreach in the year or two before the Merlet Survival Project campaign began. But I'm the first person who has led this campaign to be a in a very focused way. Before it was these organizations doing what they could with the time that they had available to spend on it, but there wasn't a real concentrated effort just because of time and resource limitations. But they were able to get some funding for this campaign, and now we have this focused effort, and then we've brought volunteers on board, and I've been able to work in my capacity to get more conservation organizations involved with this effort as well.
I see. And so your basic focus now is to basically lobby with the DNR. What else are you doing?
I do a lot of community outreach. A big part of my job is educating people, because we're trying to educate people about the marble murrelet and hopefully inspire them to take action. So there are monthly Board of Natural Resources meetings, the first Tuesday generally of every month. And the Board of Natural Resources is the supervisory body in charge of the Department of Natural Resources. So these are six individuals, all who represent Washingtonians in one way or another. And these six individuals are held accountable by the public. Some of them are statewide elected officials. Others are representative from the universities. One is a county commissioner from Clallam County. So we're trying to get as many people to these Board of Natural Resources meetings as possible to let them know that people care about the marble murrelet and that people expect this long-term conservation strategy to be based on science. So we are working with the Department of Natural Resources and the board members directly, but also we're doing a lot of activities to get the public involved, teach the public, and have them make a difference.
In his presentation that evening, Schmeltzen repeatedly made the point that the DNR perceives its mandate as cutting down trees to fund schools and other public projects, and not to help the recovery of vanishing species. The only way for that perception of purpose to change, he said, was with public pressure, and he encouraged attendees to write letters to and attend meetings of the Board of Natural Resources to speak on behalf of the marbled murrelet. You can email the board at bnr@dnr.wa.gov. For more information, you can also reach Schmeltzen by email at kevin@murreletsurvival.org or by calling 360-742-4808. This is Steve Evans reporting for KPTZ Community Radio News. This week's KPTZ Compass was written and produced by Steve Evans. The Compass airs Mondays and Saturdays at noon, Tuesdays at 5 p.m., and Wednesdays at 10 a.m., exclusively here on KPTZ, the home of eclectic, authentic community radio. KPTZ Compass is dedicated to going into the community to bring the stories from the community to the attention of the rest of the community. If you're a community-minded person and consider yourself something of a storyteller besides, perhaps you'd like to join us. We stand ready to train promising people in the subtle arts of radio journalism. If you think this might be the right kind of creative work for you, please stop by the station at the Mountain View Commons to talk with us and fill out a volunteer application. And remember, if you have a news tip or story idea of any kind, send an email to news@kptz.org. That email again for news tips is news@kptz.org. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.